Now, coincidentally, when you crash landed on Helles, the major Allied withdrawal from the Dardanelles was taking place. Could you describe the episode as you remember it?
Yes, well, they wouldn't allow me, as I said, to destroy the machine or set fire to it.
Why not?
Because they didn't want any fire occurring. Might have indicated that we were destroying stores and were going to about to leave, as we had already evacuated Suvla. So the Turks were expecting us to evacuate sometime. And any little thing like that might have given them the clue as to when it was going to be. And I went down I was sent down to W Beach and went into a lighter. And I sat there from about 6 o'clock that evening until about 1 o'clock in the following morning. She was tied up against a pier on W Beach. And the length of the pier was such it would take 3 barges each side. And the width was such that 8 men could march abreast. And they marched, there were 2 lighters on each side behind us. And the troops were marching down at the slow, and then when they got a few yards up the pier, they divided the 8 men in a rank, divided into 4. 2 went into each of the 4 barges. When the barges were full, the marching stopped, and the lighters were towed away. 4 more were brought, and so on. It went on like that all the time, until best part of 1 o'clock in the morning. All the time, there was a gun which we knew as Asiatic Annie firing at us from the other side of the strait. And they had the range pretty well exactly, and as far as I remember, they never missed us by much more than 30 yards at the outside. But all the time, they were using high explosive. So it did no damage at all. They never made a direct hit. Had they had used shrapnel, goodness knows what would have happened. They must have awful casualties. I was told afterwards that particular night the Turks had run out of shrapnel. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. But certainly they never used it.
Sounds like a very well-disciplined withdrawal.
Oh, absolutely. It was not. There was no sound. Everything went just like clockwork. And then at 1 o'clock, I finally embarked on SS Partridge, which was the second last ship to leave the peninsula. It was taken to Mudros and then sent on the supply ship back to Imbros.
Were you equipped with any new aircraft while you were at Imbros?
Yes, they sent us out the Nieuport. Two types, French machines, two types, a two-seater and a single-seater. They were very fine machines indeed. We were rather at the end of the supply line, and all machines were sent out to us without any proper armament, except that the two-seater Nieuport did have proper mounting for a gun for the observer. But the Voisin, my old Voisin, would only had a Lewis gun, which would only fire to the left and downwards. For this single-seater Nieuport, we had to cut away a little bit of the center section and mount a Lewis gun over the pilot's head, in front of him and over his head, which he could unclip, force out of a clip and train it. And he could fire in a wide arc forwards and a little bit upwards. It was quite a useful amount, really. My little Bristol, we had no proper mountings at all. We used to fix Lewis guns, one each side of the fuselage, and then just fire through the propeller and trust not to shoot it to pieces. So that I used my gun as little as possible. I just didn't like the idea of hitting my propeller too often.
These Nieuports, did they present any particular problems for you?
Yes, they were rather funnily balanced machines. Their wheels in front were very much in front, far out in front. So if they bounced, they threw their noses right up into the air, instead of bouncing up more or less with the fuselage in a horizontal position. And you're very inclined, you try to keep your tail up, and before you managed to get your tail down, they were inclined to spin round in a circle when you were on the ground and tip up onto their noses. Or if you didn't do that, when they came down the second time after a bounce, you bent the axle. Subsequently, we had no instructions as to how to fly these machines. We just had the machines were sent out in crates, and we had the instructions for tuning up, train them up. And subsequently, I moved to another station where there was a French squadron who were experts on them, and they told us we were landing them all wrong, because we were told that you had to land them on their wheels, the tail in the air, and gradually bring the tail down. The Frenchman told me that I ought to throw them at the ground anyhow. They were going to bounce, so why worry? And then very violent movements of the joystick, which they explained to me. And you could bring them down from their bounce, make a good three-point landing. And I never had any trouble in landing them after that, after the French had told me exactly how they should be landing.
You mentioned this problem of armament, that none of the aircraft you were equipped with at this time were really properly armed. Did this fact cause you any particular difficulties in, for example, combat?
Well, it caused the difficulty that one withheld one's fire until one was pretty sure of it. At least I did in the little Bristol, because I was firing through a prop. I did bind the prop with fabric, and dope fabric. Whether that did much good or not, I don't know. It may have prevented splinters coming out. So that you couldn't judge, and you couldn't practice. I didn't practice dive by, sort of diving at the ground and practicing firing, because we just didn't have enough props to go around. I did have one scrap with a Fokker in my Bristol. I met him over the peninsula, and we flew at each other. And then I saw him starting to turn left. Now, the one thing I knew he was going to turn left, the one thing a Fokker didn't like doing was turning to the right. I think that was due to the gyroscopic force of his engine. He was always inclined to go into a dive if he turned to the right. And I turned to the left, and I threw my machine into a vertical turn, and I turned through about 360 degrees while he turned through 180. Instead of him coming out on my tail, I came out on his. And I found it a little difficult to line up. He kept turning, and I found it a little difficult to get straight onto him. However, I did have several good bursts, and I could see my tracers going into his fuselage, though I don't think I damaged him. And then he went into a dive, and I couldn't dive as fast as a Fokker could. And he got away, and the other machine that was with me, a pilot in the Newport, he dived down. Also had a go at the Fokker. And when he had finished with him, I saw the Fokker well below me, and I went into a dive, and I dived about 5,000 feet, and did manage to get Fokker didn't seem to know I was coming, but I did get a few more bursts at him, and then he dived right away from me and went right low down.
Are there any particular incidences relating to the monitor shelling operations which you can remember?
Yes, well, not only did we go and spot for them, that was mainly before the evacuation, but afterwards they used to drop a few shells in the peninsula, perhaps once or twice a week. And I don't think they minded very much where they landed. They just wanted to keep up, show the flag, so to speak. And one of the old monitors got too lazy to go out of Kefalo Harbour, but her gun mountings weren't such as to give enough elevation to the guns to reach the peninsula, although the guns were quite capable of it. So they used to flood the blisters on one side and heel the ship over. And that enabled them to get enough elevation to reach the peninsula. On one occasion, number three wing was between the monitor, it was on a little promontory between the monitor and the peninsula, a sort of branch of the land round Kefalo Harbour. And the shells going over tore off the roof of the sergeant's mess, much to the annoyance of the sergeants.
Now, you were flying this Bristol Scout a good deal of the time while you were at Imbros. Did you find this a satisfactory aircraft?
Yes, it was an excellent aircraft, but I did want more power to keep up with the Nieuport Scouts, which had come up by then. And I took the 80 Gnome out and put in a 90 Lerone, which was the engine which the Nieuports used. And I had to use the Nieuport propellers with the Lerone engine. This again made it, it reinforces what I said about not being able to use one's guns too much, because we just didn't have enough propellers. And the first time I flew the Bristol with the Nieuport, just to give it a test flight, when I landed the Bristol in the ordinary course of events, one got within a few inches of the ground and just let her stall, and she'd make a beautiful three-point landing. She had a lifting tail, so that as you stalled, the tail was inclined to would drop. When I put in the Lerone engine, the Lerone weighed, as far as I remember, about 90 pounds more than the Gnome. And 90 pounds right in the nose of a very small aeroplane like that made quite a difference to the characteristic at stall. And when I landed, instead of coming down and making a nice three-point landing, she put her nose down and bounced. And I tried to take her off again, but one of the usual gusts of winds came down from the hills and blew me round, and I started charging the hill where there was a low wall. I saw I couldn't get over the wall, so I put her nose right down, flew straight into the ground. Of course, one's got to remember that with the Bristol, if there was any wind about, I could land without running at all. I could just put her on the ground in the head. I mean, so one mustn't train at a high speed. Very little damage was done. I damaged the machine a bit, smashed my propeller, unfortunately, but otherwise not much damage was done.
Apart from your flying activities from Imbros, how did you spend the time when you weren't flying, and what was the sort of quality of life like?
Well, we were really very comfortable. We had a stone-built mess room, which was really two rooms and a kitchen. What you might call the first room was the gun room, and the next room was the wardroom. We all ate in the wardroom. We lived in aeroplane packing cases. A packing case, and the aeroplane sent out were various shapes, but I suppose they were about 10 feet long, perhaps 7 feet high, and possibly 7 feet wide, that sort of thing. And they were lined with tarred paper, and you could just get two camp beds in, one each side, and they were really relatively warm. One of our little games was that you'd hear a scratching noise on your paper on the inside of the shed, and you'd locate it as accurately as you could, and then stick a knife in, and then you'd cut a little slit, and at the end of your knife you'd probably find about a 6-inch centipede. Pull that out and stuck sticky paper over the little slit you'd made, and it was neatly done. It was all right. And I think the comfort, there was my particular packing case was close to a hill, and in the hill was a grave, and as far as I could see, this grave was dug down into the solid rock, and when they put a body in, they put concrete on top, and I suppose they went up until they filled the grave up. But when I was there, there was about 2 or 3 feet of unoccupied space before you came to the edge of the rock. And if the Hun came over with bombs at night, I used to jump out of bed and run and lie down in the grave. And unless he made a direct hit, I was quite safe.